From NPR News and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. We begin with a huge fine announced today against Wells Fargo. The bank has agreed to pay federal regulators $1 billion for committing a number of unsafe and unsound practices involving its auto insurance and home loans. It's the largest fine levied by the Trump administration against a bank. And Wells Fargo CEO Timothy Sloan said today that the bank has made progress to, quote, make things right for our customers. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
The fine comes from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Walk us through what Wells Fargo has done to get this fine. Why don't you start off with car insurance?
All right. So with car insurance, basically what happened was when someone would take out a loan at Wells Fargo to buy a car, the bank would create what's called collateral protection insurance policies. And then they would add charges to the customer's auto loan bills to pay for this insurance. Now, they did this oftentimes without notifying the customers that they were doing it. And many of the drivers were actually already covered for this under their own policies. It's believed more than 500,000 clients may have unwittingly paid for this protection. And again, many of them didn't need it.
Many of them didn't need it. And apparently there were many who were charged for auto insurance that they didn't need, but they couldn't afford that insurance and ended up having their cars repossessed. Will they eventually get a share of the $1 billion?
Well, as part of the order today with the government, in addition to the fines, the bank is being ordered to pay restitution to customers. And there are lawsuits. Wells Fargo has several different problems like this that it's dealing with. And there are lawsuits involved in all of them sort of working their way through.
Fine also pertains to practices in the bank's mortgage business. What happened there?
So with mortgages, basically what happened is they were accused of imposing inappropriate charges for customers to lock in interest rates on home loans. According to one lawsuit, Wells Fargo's employees would wrongfully blame customers for delays in loan processing and then make them pay fees in order to maintain a lock on the interest rate that would otherwise expire. And Wells Fargo had acknowledged that it could have to refund as much as $98 million in fees because of this.
In February, Mike, the Federal Reserve punished Wells Fargo for a different issue. That was millions of fake bank accounts created by employees for Wells Fargo. The Fed said that Wells Fargo can't grow any larger until it's changed its ways. So the punishment then and the fine today, how much could they affect the bank's bottom line?
So what happens is banks typically keep money in reserve to pay for legal issues like this. So Wells Fargo had some money tucked away to pay this $1 billion, but it was quite a big fine. So they had to add another $800 million in reserve accruals to pay for this. So that takes their profit just for the first quarter of the year down to $4.7 billion. So they're still making plenty of money to pay for this. What's very interesting about this settlement, however, is it also gives the government power to basically fire some of the managers within the bank, which is quite an unusual thing for something like this.
It's the first enforcement measure taken by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau since Mick Mulvaney took over as interim director. He has been critical of the Bureau. So what do you make of the fact that he's involved here?
So in general, with Mr. Mulvaney and the Trump administration in general, the policy has basically been that they do believe banks are saddled with too many regulations, and they want to get rid of a lot of the regulations. However, when a bank does break the rules, especially when it affects regular sort of average Joe consumers like this, the administration has made it clear that they aren't going to give banks a pass, really. In fact, President Trump has tweeted exactly that, saying, if they do get caught breaking the rules, he called it cheating, that there will be big fines to pay. So, I think this is perhaps an example of that sort of policy playing out in real life.
So in the last week, the country's biggest banks, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, have been reporting extremely strong earnings numbers, in large part because they've seen their tax bills fall after the Republican tax bill. How does the announcement today fit in with how banks have been doing under the administration?
Well, Wells Fargo is a little unique in that it has had all these various serious issues and scandals involving its consumer business. Most of the other banks, after paying for all the various wrongdoing during the financial crisis, haven't had to deal with this type of thing. From the stock market's perspective, I mean, the banks have just been doing great since President Trump was elected. An index of all the major bank stocks in the U.S. had risen as much as about 54%. It's down a little bit since then, but still 40% higher since the election. So the market is very happy with the way they're getting treated, clearly.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Now to Turkey, where opposition parties are scrambling to mount a challenge to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan with just 9 weeks to go before a snap election. President Erdogan set the election for June 24th, more than a year ahead of schedule, and the Turkish parliament today approved it. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul. And Mark, there's still a state of emergency in Turkey after the failed 2016 coup. What's going on here with these snap elections? Is this just a strong man flexing his muscles?
I think it's a strongman president catching the opposition off guard, Eric. For long, there was talk of a possible early election, but the idea that it would be brought forward this early was really a bolt from the blue. I think what he's trying to do with this is two things, really. First of all, to clip the wings of his main rival, who is a former interior minister, Meral Akşener, who formed a new party on the right just a few months ago. But also, I think that President Erdogan sees potential economic storms on the horizon. The Turkish lira has reached record lows this year against the dollar and against the euro. Mm. Inflation is stubbornly high. There's a yawning trade deficit. So I think what President Erdogan's trying to do is to preempt any economic crash with an early election. Of course, what he says is that's not the case. That what he says is he's just trying to bring clarity to Turkey, given that there was a constitutional referendum last year that narrowly passed a change in Turkey's political system from a parliamentary to a presidential republic to endow the presidency with more powers. And that will only come into place with a new election. So he says that is needed now.
Interesting. And there are serious economic dark clouds on the horizon. And since the attempted coup 2 years ago, President Erdogan has cracked down hard, Mark, on political dissent. He's jailed thousands of opponents, fired thousands of civil servants. He's jailed and censored journalists. There's hardly a free press in Turkey. Are these likely to be truly free and fair elections?
I don't think anybody expects them to be free and fair elections. The constitutional referendum last year was heavily criticized by the OSCE election watchdog as being hugely flawed in many ways, not least because the government has near total control of the media here. About 90% of the Turkish media is now either owned by barons very close to President Erdogan or very pro-government. It's very difficult for the opposition to make its voice heard. The vote might be free, but it is not expected to be fair. And what's more, there was a new electoral law passed recently that would allow, for example, ballot papers that have not been verified or authenticated by the electoral board with an official stamp to be counted. So that gives rise to the potential for ballot papers to be photocopied outside and then brought in and stamped and stuffed into ballot boxes and counted. And also, for example, a voter might be able to call in armed security if they have concern about another voter. And in a country where there is deep polarization, where there is a culture now of people sort of telling and snitching on others, that gives rise to other fears as well. And as you mentioned, Eric, the state of emergency imposed just after the failed coup in 2016 has been extended. So this will be the first time that Turkey has a parliamentary and a presidential election under a state of emergency, which, of course, creates other concerns.
So people can call in armed security at the voting booths? I mean, that seems like intimidation.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what people fear here. I mean, the government says that they're doing that in order to counter the threat from Kurdish militants, the PKK, as they say, a terrorist group. But everybody expects that it will be widely abused by people who suspect that there will be not enough votes for the government or that they want to kind of intimidate potential voters into voting in a certain way. So there are real concerns already about whether the vote is going to be free and fair, and that's 9 weeks before the election even takes place.
Mark, finally, one of the persons arrested in Erdogan's crackdown is an American pastor named Andrew Brunson. What does Erdogan gain by pursuing this case against an American pastor?
the suspicion is that this is part of hostage diplomacy, because remember that a Turkish cleric, Fethullah Gülen, has been living in Pennsylvania since 1999 and is believed by the Turkish government to have orchestrated the failed coup here. He's a political rival, an Islamist political rival to President Erdogan, and he has a huge network of followers right around the globe, in fact, but particularly in Turkey. And the Turkish government desperately wants him extradited here. But at the moment, Washington is saying, look, this is an independent judicial system here in the US. It will be up to the courts to decide. The president can't click his fingers and get this man extradited as there could be in Turkey. So the suspicion is that Andrew Brunson is being held for some kind of hostage swap. The government says that there are proper charges against Andrew Brunson, that he is believed to have somehow colluded with the Gülen network and with Kurdish militants. They say he did propaganda for terrorism. But I think it's the American government has already ruled out any kind of swap or prison swap or whatever or exchange with Turkey on this. And really, this is something that is adding to Turkish-US friction at the moment.
Hostage diplomacy, a bit of an oxymoron. The BBC's Mark Lowen in Istanbul. Mark, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Matlin is 55 years old, married with children, a cat, and a turtle. Pretty standard stuff, but with a twist. Matlin has never been able to walk or even stand. He was born with a neuromuscular condition called type 2 spinal muscular atrophy. The disorder is rare and incurable. Because of it, Matlin's in a wheelchair. The disease didn't stop him, though, from graduating from Harvard and forging a career in journalism and writing books about life with a neurodegenerative disease. His newest is a revealing exploration of 15 couples who fall in love, interabled couples, as he calls them, where only one partner has a disability. The book is called In Sickness and in Health: Love, Disability, and a Quest to Understand the Perils and Pleasures of Interabled Romance. Ben Matlin joins us now. Welcome.
Hello.
The book delves into the stories of 15 couples, their relationships, and disabilities. Start off by telling us, though, a little bit about yourself and what having spinal muscular atrophy has meant for you.
Well, I mean, it's something I was born with, so it's sort of original equipment. But I've been fortunate. I've had a pretty good, normal life, so I always expected that normal things would happen, including love and marriage and having children.
And it did. You've got two kids now, right?
Yes.
You've been married for how many years?
About 30.
And Mary Lois, your wife, was also your first girlfriend, right?
That's true.
So you describe your first date in the book. You were 19 years old. You said that you made Mary Lois walk 30 blocks in Manhattan because taxicabs back then were not wheelchair accessible. I wonder if that was like a crash course in what it's like to date Ben Matlin.
Perhaps. I mean, I lived up on the 82nd Street, and the concert we were going to was wherever it was in the 50s. But there was no other choice, no other way to get there in those days. This is in the 1980s, before the Americans with Disabilities Act, before the buses or anything was really accessible. You know, I tried to make light of it, and because that was the only option available.
You wondered in your head at that point what was going on in her head, and you interviewed her for the book. What did she tell you about that?
She was thinking more about me. When I suggested she ride on my lap, she recalls thinking, I can't do that because it might hurt you. You look delicate. And I had to reassure her, it's fine, you can do it. Don't worry.
And I think that's one of the things that made her, according to your book anyway, fall in love with you. Before we get into some of the other stories, I wonder, when you were coming of age, when you were a college student, did you ever consider the fact that your condition, the fact that you can't move your hands too much, right? And you can't move your body at all. Is that correct?
That's true, yes.
Yeah. Did it make you wonder if love would ever happen or be complicated? I know you said this became normal for you, so you expected things to happen. Did it ever concern you that it might be unattainable in this world?
Honestly, no. I was cocky. I was overconfident, perhaps naive. Although looking back now at my age, I kind of wonder about that. For the reason I wrote the book. And so I kind of want to examine how it happened, why it's lasted so long, and instead of just looking at me, at us, that's why I brought in other couples to get a sense of how things are these days.
So among the people that you spoke with are couples where one person in the couple has multiple sclerosis, somebody with brittle bone syndrome, somebody else who's paralyzed. One of those people who's paralyzed is Rachel Friedman, who, as a bride-to-be, was paralyzed after someone pushed her into a pool at her bachelorette party just a couple days before her wedding. She ended up getting married to that same man. But how did that experience redefine her relationship?
Well, she says that they are still so well matched that it really didn't matter. And I kind of questioned that. You had to kind of redefine yourselves, right? Because they manage, you know, they have a child. That was her kind of big struggle when I spoke to her, was things like, you know, changing diapers and being a mom with limited use of her hands. But she did tell me an interesting story that I could sort of relate to.
Yeah.
The people sometimes tell her husband what a hero he is for being with her. And that makes her angry because he's not doing me some favor. You know, it's not that he's missing out on something because of my disability. And she really felt that wasn't fair, and I could understand that completely.
You can understand it because you write that people say that about your wife, Mary Lois, as well, that, you know, she's a saint and you're lucky to have found love.
That kind of view is based on an assumption, a prejudice, that the disabled person is a deficit. And that's not really fair. I mean, we are so much more than our physical limitations. Yes, there are situations, of course, where it doesn't work out. But my disability was part of what's made me who I am. So to separate it out really makes no sense.
You know, we all come with our stuff. You know, we all come with our baggage in any way. Do you feel as though you're able to give as much as you get? Because I know that Mary Lois offers you a lot of help in many ways. You write about that in the book. Do you feel, especially as you age together, that you can give back?
Well, I make a point of it. I make sure I do. I mean, one thing I do, I think, in our relationship, I tend to be the connection with the outside world. I mean, I keep track of family birthdays. I keep in touch with, cousins and distant relatives. And the finances, I pay all the bills and take care of the taxes. And I've tended to often to set the agenda. I think, you know, what's on TV tonight or what movie should we go see? That kind of thing. So there's emotional support that I give her and a sense of humor. And every weekend, we do the crossword puzzle together. and we are a team. We are a partnership.
And what about parenthood? How has that changed a relationship?
Well, like any couple, I guess. Kids are time-consuming and expensive. And of course, bring a tremendous, not just joy, but a sense of purpose. There were rough times when they were small, when they were babies, and my wife had to do more of the physical stuff. But I made sure I contributed. I found ways to play with them, to watch them in the tub, tell them stories, sing them songs. I learned how to change a diaper, even though I couldn't do it physically. I could direct someone to do it for me if need be.
That's not nothing.
Well, I tried, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be passive or be lazy about it. I wanted to be an equal contributor or participant, and I believe I have been.
Ben, I want to ask you about one of the women that you interviewed. She has spina bifida. Her name is Doreen. She remembered that her mother once told her that she would never find a husband because, quote, sex wasn't even in the cards. How does sex factor into these relationships?
Certainly there are some people who grew up with their disabilities whose parents, yes, told them you know, you're not going to ever find love. You're going to be with mom and dad forever. Maybe the parents mean well to protect the kids from disappointment, but it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. What was kind of neat for me to learn is that, you know, nowadays young people, it's all online. So even Shane in my book, who's 23, I think, when I first spoke to him, he blogged and he was able to be honest about his limitations, but also get his personality, I guess, out there online. Obviously, some people care more about sex than others, or there are degrees of intimacy that people can enjoy. But it's important, really, actually, to stress that these couples are lovers. They are physical with each other, intimate in certain ways. But that's part of the problem we talked about before, calling one a saint or whatever. It tends to desexualize or infantilize the disabled person. And that's really not fair or accurate.
What would you tell people who are listening right now who might be disabled and looking for love, or people who are able-bodied and considering life with someone who is disabled? What would you say?
I guess I would say don't give up hope. It may not be easy, but one thing my book, I hope, shows, and it's a testament to the fact that it is possible for a variety of situations, types of disabilities. It does happen. People do find love, and they do make it work.
Thank you. Really nice to speak with you. Ben Madlin, author of In Sickness and in Health, Love, Disability, and a Quest to Understand the Perils and Pleasures of Interabled Romance. Nice to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
There are nearly 800 Texas National Guard troops on the state's border with Mexico today, and hundreds more on the way. The deployment is in response to a call to action by President Trump, who says there's been an uptick in illegal border crossings and drug trafficking. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame visited border towns to see how locals are reacting to the troops.
Maria Reyes lives in Mercedes, Texas, just a couple miles from the banks of the Rio Grande. A gravel road leads to her home on a shaded property squeezed between the river's floodplain and a nature preserve. Reyes is no stranger to the U.S. Border Patrol. They park their vehicles nearby and walk the perimeter of her property. Reyes's dog, Butch, is so used to their presence that he doesn't even bark.
I've seen them practically every day at different times.
She says it's been several months since she encountered someone on her property who'd crossed over illegally, but she remains open to the idea of National Guard members along the border.
They're doing what they're told to do. I think their way of helping is just making sure that nobody crosses or whatever and telling the Border Patrol what's happening. I have no problem with that.
The Rio Grande Valley, where Reyes lives, accounts for 43% of the marijuana seized along the border. And while the total number of border apprehensions is historically low, Border Patrol Chief Manuel Padilla says he's seen a concerning increase in gang member crossings, tractor-trailer smuggling incidents, and stash houses since March of last year. Padilla spoke in the border town of Weslaco about what he called a chaotic border environment and said Border Patrol doesn't have enough resources to counter the threat.
So we do not have control. Let me be very, very clear on that, right? We do a great job as an agency, as an interagency partner, but at the end of the day, we still have a lot of traffic.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, enthusiastically supports President Trump's plan to secure the border. He defended the mission in a briefing with National Guard troops.
This operation is necessary in order to deal with what has been an escalation of cross-border traffic.
The National Guard doesn't have the authority to make arrests. Instead, they'll support Border Patrol operations by clearing roads, maintaining vehicles, and providing air surveillance. Others may help out at ports of entry. But for some in the Rio Grande Valley, the Guard's presence is puzzling or downright unwelcome. Organizers from the immigrant aid organization La Unión del Pueblo Entero gathered to protest what they call militarization of the border. "This is a border zone, not a war zone," they chanted. John Michael Torres was among them. He's seen past National Guard deployments to the area and says they free up Border Patrol and create opportunities for abuse.
You know, they don't have a whole lot to do. If we keep giving them resources, they're going to find things to do, and part of that is going to be harassing our members of the members of our community.
A short drive north of the border, Xavier Reyes prepares drinks behind the counter of Weslaco's Daily Grind, a coffee shop that draws a mixed crowd of snowbirds and locals. Reyes has lived in Weslaco his whole life. He says he's already noticed a few National Guard members thirsting for caffeine. He says he doesn't have a strong opinion about the National Guard deployment, but he worries that attitudes in the country are turning against immigrants.
I hear a lot like, "Oh, they come over here, they steal our jobs, you know, or they're doing this and that." I just feel maybe there's a lack of empathy and understanding going on right now, and I don't think it's going to end well.
For now, the National Guard continues its mobilization along the border. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
That's Uptown, the lead single on Prince's album Dirty Mind. It's been 2 years since Prince was found dead at his home near Minneapolis. He died from a fentanyl overdose. Prince's contributions to the world go far beyond his music, and his impact was the focus of a kind of celebration and symposium at the University of Minnesota this week. It was called Prince from Minneapolis. Among the organizers is Elliot Powell, assistant professor at the university. Professor Powell, Prince was a monstrous talent and entertainer, but why do you think there should be an international symposium about him?
Prince did so much in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality, in terms of music. And so there are people whose lives have been touched, whose careers have been touched by Prince. And so we have people from all over the world talking about Prince and race and Prince and his kind of play with gender and sexuality, things about Prince and activism. It really sort of runs the gamut here.
Part of this is not just to put the spotlight on Prince, but also his home. That's why you're calling the conference Prince from Minneapolis. How do the two go together?
It matters in a number of ways, the kinds of connections between Minneapolis and Prince. For one, Prince would always talk about Minneapolis in his music. He had songs called Uptown or Calhoun Square that are spaces that people from Minneapolis will know. And so we wanted to highlight the fact that Prince never left Minneapolis. He always made it known to both us here, but people across the globe, that this is where he's from. It's almost a gift to him because he gave so much to us.
Well, let's go to Prince and music. We're going to play a song from the soundtrack of Purple Rain. It's called The Beautiful Ones.
Can't you stay with me tonight? Oh, baby, baby, don't pop kisses, please, you right. You are so hard to find.
Within the song, like The Beautiful Ones, Prince, through his voice, through the lyrics, through really the music, is trying to, for me at least, speak to all the kinds of complexities around love and about vulnerability and anxiety and hurt and passion.
It's a beautiful song, The Beautiful
yes,
Ones.
That but, is also true.
But let me be a heretic.
Okay.
Are we being overly analytical about a really nice pop song by a great pop star?
I think it's different for Prince because one of the things that I think people really overlook about Prince is how gifted of a songwriter he was and is. And I think The Beautiful Ones is one of those songs where on paper it's gorgeous, but then the way in which he's able to bring even more life to that song through his voice and through performance. Prince was a fantastic live performer. And what many people who have seen Prince live will tell you is that his approach to really the music when he performs it live just opens up so many different understandings of the song.
And we know that he talked about politics and police brutality in his music. In 2015, he released a tribute song, Baltimore, that called for justice and peace in the wake of the death of Freddie Gray. Let's listen to a clip of it.
We're tired of crying and people dying. Let's take all the guns away.
Weight did his words carry?
They carried a ton of weight. Prince wanted to, again, use the platform of music, use his own kind of iconic status to make a statement, a very powerful statement about the state of really Black lives within the U.S.
So when Prince is talking about things like Black Lives Matter, you have spent the past couple of days with people from around the world who listen to his music and take to heart messages like that. But how do they? I mean, how does somebody from a different part of the world hear that message?
Yeah, I think with that kind of question, and it's a great question, I think we have to also consider a notion around global Blackness, the kinds of discrimination that people of really African descent across the world face various forms of discrimination. And so for Prince to actually say Black Lives Matter means something to also Black people across the globe who are facing those similar kinds of issues around sort of institutional racism, around really police brutality.
Thank you. Elliot Powell from the University of Minnesota. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
There's a kind of dance called stepping, not to be confused with Irish step dancing. This one has roots in African-American culture, and you use your whole body to mix rhythms and make sounds. The dance form is popular at high schools and colleges. In Washington, D.C., only one public middle school has a competitive step team, the Kelly Miller Middle School. Kids compete against a few other middle schools in the region, and as Kate McGee from member station WAMU reports, these students say they're ready for even more competition.
The sound of the 8-member Kelly Miller step team screaming, stomping, and clapping echoes through the bright, clean hallways of the middle school. They're reviewing step combinations for their final competition this year, and they've got a first-place title to defend, 2 years running. The step team has only been around for a few years. It was started by two teachers at the school who also used to step. They've built a name for themselves, says 7th grader Shalaya Dean, who is also the co-captain.
We're like the jocks at our school. The step team reps Kelly Miller. We're always lit, and like they really like us.
Not only is stepping physically challenging, it requires a lot of performance and emotion. Dean likes that.
You could be petty, you could be mean, you could be nice. Like, you could be like, that's what you get, you can't beat us.
But 8th grader Tamia Robertson says there's only one problem, a lack of competition. There just aren't that many teams in the district.
We went first place, so like, we want more competition than what we're getting right now to make it harder for us. So, because right now it's not hard, so we're being cocky just to make it harder.
There is no competition on this stage, they say, in this step combination.
Lions Den will take first place!
Step team is a commitment. Students must keep up their grades to perform, and they practice almost every day for hours. Practices include learning the step routines and endurance training. Coaches Shanice Payne and Tatiana Anderson Bowman say when students try out every year, most have little experience stepping.
So we have to build them up in order to be able to stomp and clap and put together a show.
Coach Anderson Bowman started the step group so that students and teachers can connect outside the classroom. Coach Payne says middle school students are often still figuring out who they are. Stepping can help.
I think the most challenging part of stepping for middle school students is finding that alter ego. Would you agree? Yeah. Definitely. So
sometimes we have to be like, you're not Tamika today, you're Tiffany.
And just be different and go out the box.
Performing in perfect unison requires trust and communication. Tristan Washington is a seventh grader and the only boy on the team this year. He says that's his favorite part.
I haven't had collaboration with anybody since I was growing up. So like I've like found like a second family to collaborate with.
Even though stepping is physically challenging, Washington says at their school, boys see it as a girl sport. That doesn't bother him, but it annoys Shalaya Dean.
All we do is mean faces, so I don't know where they get that from.
This is not a game! Ha, ha!
The Kelly Miller step team will get a taste of the competition it's been craving. Later this month, they'll step against some high school teams from the Washington, D.C. region. They're nervous, but students say that won't stop them from challenging their opponents on stage.
Ha, 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 ha!
For Here and Now, I'm Kate McGee.
More than 200 priests from around the world are in Rome this week for an annual Vatican training course on how to perform exorcisms, the ritual used by the Catholic Church to free people who are believed to be possessed by demons. Topics included one panel titled Magic, Esoteric and Occult Links to Some Alternative and Energy-Giving Therapies. And it turns out demand for exorcisms is on the rise. We may think of it the way it's depicted in the 1973 classic horror movie The Exorcist.
It's the power of Christ that compels you. The power of Christ!
Not a completely accurate portrayal, and our next guest would go as far as to call it sensational. Joining us is Vince Lampert, pastor at Malachi Parish in Brownsburg, Indiana. He's also the official exorcist for the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. And Father Vince, welcome to Here and Now.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
First off, explain a little what a real-life exorcism entails from your experience.
An exorcism at its very core is an official prayer of the church. So oftentimes people might be more interested in the theatrics or the sensationalism, but it really is a prayer whereby God is asked to bring relief into the life of the person who is suffering, or it can be an imperative exorcism, a command given to the demon, commanding it to depart by the name and the authority of Christ.
And you've done both kinds. You've brought people into a room and simply talked to them or prayed with them, and then you've done the other more, I guess, theatrical version as well?
Yes, I've done many, many exorcisms. There's different degrees of extraordinary demonic activity. The church recognizes demonic possession, but it also recognizes demonic infestation, the presence of evil in a location or with an object, demonic vexation, physical attacks, and then demonic obsession, mental attacks. So it could be that I've done literally thousands of exorcisms when it comes to infestation, vexation, and obsession.
Father, confession here. I'm an exorcist skeptic. When the archbishop asked you to be the diocese exorcist, what was your response?
Yeah, I was a bit taken aback when my bishop asked me to do this. So it wasn't a job that I was seeking. It was one that I was appointed to do.
Were you at all skeptical at first?
I believe in the reality of evil, but the church also moves very methodically because the church wants to make sure that a person gets the true help that they need. Just because somebody says they're possessed doesn't mean that the church necessarily believes that's the case. So there is a process or protocol that's used before the church gets to that determination.
Well, talk about that process and protocol. How do you know someone who calls you isn't simply suffering from a mental illness as opposed to being genuinely possessed by the devil?
That's a great question because an exorcist is trained to be a skeptic. So the church does require a person that believes that they're dealing with extraordinary demonic activity, if they're possessed, to have a complete psychiatric evaluation because the church wants experts in the mental health field to weigh in so that the church can make sure that this is something not just of a mental nature. The church also requires the person to have a physical examination by a medical doctor. It's important to note that the church is not asking the mental health expert or the medical doctor if a person is possessed. The church always makes that determination herself, but the church does want experts in these areas to weigh in on the matter so that the church can reach a level of moral certitude before proceeding with the ritual of exorcism.
So you want a report from a psychiatrist in your hand before you perform an exorcism?
Absolutely, yes.
We're reading that more and more people, not just Catholics, are seeking out exorcisms. You've been an exorcist for 13 years. What kind of call volume have you been seeing?
Early on, I would probably get about five calls a week. currently in 2017, I received an average of 30 calls a week.
30 calls a week. Why do you think that is? Why the rising demand for this?
I believe because faith in general seems to be declining in the Western world. And so I always say that belief in God leads us in one direction, and the lack of belief in God will lead us in another.
With the increase in demand, more priests are being trained in this ritual. You attended the Vatican training in exorcism in 2006, the same training that's going on this week in Rome. What did you learn there?
They bring together people, experts from all different fields, whether it's psychiatrists, medical doctors, people involved in police, ritual abuses, attacks, you name it. So the church wants to really have a thorough course covering all different areas and aspects of this ministry so that those being trained can look at it from many, many different angles.
We're reading that some priests are now performing exorcisms by cell phone or Skype. Is that common? Is that legitimate?
That would not be legitimate. The church would say that an exorcism has to be done in person. The truth is, and I believe this, that if the church moves too hastily, then perhaps she might label someone as being possessed, when in reality they might need the help of a good mental health expert or to go see their medical doctor. And then the church would be doing greater harm than good.
Vince Lampert is a pastor at St. Malachy Parish in Brownsburg, Indiana. He's also the official exorcist for the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. Father Vince, thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR News and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Have a great weekend. I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Robin Young is back on Monday. This is Here and Now.